Welcome to Future Makers, your invitation to cutting-edge debates on our changing society with leading thinkers from the University of Oxford and beyond. Today, we're discussing how the UK can transition to a sustainable energy future and whether nuclear power should have a role in that development. Nuclear power is viewed very negatively by many people, with dangerous accidents and horrific weapons being at the top of their minds when they hear the words. But less controversial, renewable energy sources are not without their critics. And arguably, they haven't yet reached the point technologically where they can entirely replace our current energy systems. So what role can or should nuclear power be playing in the UK energy sector as we move towards a sustainable future? With me to discuss this today are Professor Nick Eyre, Director of the Centre for Research into Energy Demand Solutions, who in 1997 wrote the first published study of how the then government's target of a 20% reduction in carbon emissions might be achieved. Dr. Sarah Darby, Acting Leader of the Energy Programme at Oxford's Environmental Change Institute, who has a particular interest in how energy systems might develop in more environmentally and socially benign ways, and James Marrow, James Martin Professor of Energy Materials at Oxford University, whose work is focused on the degradation of structural materials. Thank you all for coming and welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Nick, could we start with painting the picture of what the current energy sector looks like in the UK?
Yes, certainly. The short message is that it's dominated by fossil fuels, which is why we have a pressing problem to address climate change. So if we look at the whole of the energy sector, it's about 40% oil, 40% gas, and then smaller contributions from coal, from nuclear, and from renewables. And that's because our heating of buildings and our industrial processes, the fuel is dominated by gas. In the transport sector, our vehicles are almost entirely fueled by oil. And it's only really for electricity generation that we have a more of a fuel mix, with fossil fuels contributing about half, nuclear about 20%, and renewables about 30%. So what we're seeing is perhaps faster changes now than we've seen in current decades. We're seeing falling demand. So UK energy demand has fallen at about 1% a year for the last 15 years. And that's because energy efficiency is happening faster than the demand for energy services is rising. And that's probably not as well widely known as it ought to be. And then we're seeing quite a rapid growth in renewable energy, in power generation, particularly wind energy, but from a very low base. So renewables now in total contribute about 12% of UK energy demand. It's growing, but it's hard work to make that grow. And ultimately, the non-fossil fuels are going to have to replace the fossil fuels by 2050, hopefully, but that's a pretty tough target.
Right, thank you. Sarah, do you want to add to that picture?
What Nick says about energy demand in this country broadly applies worldwide in terms of the reliance either on fossil fuels or in quite a lot of countries, reliance on what's known as traditional biomass, so burning wood, crop residues, dung, that sort of thing. So similar considerations certainly apply. Also, of course, there is a big question of global equity and the aspirations of a lot of people who are aspiring to modern energy services, but are a long way from achieving them yet. So that's certainly a consideration in this debate.
Nick has already said a bit about how we're being more cautious in our use of energy. We're presumably insulating more. I mean, do you see big changes coming there, and how far would those apply elsewhere?
Change is certainly happening. It's not always happening in the direction we'd like. So I think one of the most alarming things that's going on at the moment in the hotter countries of the world is the number of buildings that are going up that are being built to a fairly standard design with concrete and glass. They're very hard to live in without some form of mechanical cooling. And that's locking in a lot of energy demand for the future. Certainly, change is badly needed there to be designing climatically appropriate buildings, as you might say, partly learning lessons from traditional architecture of the past, so that we're not locking in all this demand for the future, but people can get their energy service, they can get their level of comfort from much more from the building and from natural ventilation than they would from one that has been designed for a cool climate, for example.
From what you've both been saying, it sounds like there's no room for complacency here, that we hear a lot of noise about move towards renewables. But in fact, where we are right now, there's still a huge need for fossil fuels. And that's where nuclear may come in, I presume. James, can you tell us a bit about the role that nuclear currently plays in the UK system and more widely?
Okay, a little bit. I mean, we've been busy in nuclear for, you know, number of decades. UK is one of the first countries to build plant. But it's also important to put nuclear in its context. I mean, Nick gave a nice picture of our energy use. I mean, nuclear is, depends on the day of the week, but it's about 15-20% of our electricity, which Nick says about 20% of our total energy. So in the total energy mix at the moment, nuclear is actually a rather small player. And so I think it's always important to realise this difference between electricity and energy and always be very clear about which one we are talking about. So but in terms of going back to the UK nuclear, we, as an early player, we're now reaching a position where most of what we built is ageing. And so a lot of the issues in the UK are keeping the old plant going long enough, first to meet our energy demands, but also to maintain the infrastructure of engineers and all the support structure that goes around that, so that if we want to go for more nuclear as part of the mix, we're in the position to do it as a nation. Because if we leave it another decade, maybe a couple of decades, we will have no way to make that choice.
Why is that?
Well, without going all the way back to the beginning again to rebuild the infrastructure and the ways of doing it, you know, it's not a quick fix. Nuclear, it is a difficult technology in both to build and to run and to maintain and to regulate. You know, you wouldn't build a whole aviation industry from scratch in short of a couple of decades. So, it's something one can always do, but if you don't maintain that ability, then when the time comes, if you do decide to go for that technology, you either have to bring that technology in from somewhere else, which imposes costs and controls, or you want, as a government or a nation, you might want to make a decision that we will maintain that capability so we can make a choice. So that's the position I think the UK is in at the moment.
So quite a potentially important crossroads.
I think we are at a crossroads, yes. We have to make a decision. Are we in and going to and delay the decision a little bit longer, or are we out? And if we're out, then we put our energies into other things. And I think it's a thing that's been coming the past decade, this realization that we need to make a choice. And so there are things going on to reinvigorate the nuclear sector, both at the university research side and in industry around. And one could argue that the building of plants like Hinkley Point C is a way of maintaining UK capability and deciding whether it fits in the market. One of the sides of the challenges that nuclear in the UK sees at the moment is the difficulties that have been in finding investors in the new plant, which the government wants to build in the UK to maintain that side of the energy sector. So going back to the point, yes, I think nuclear is at a crossroads. I personally think it's part of the future energy mix. Internationally, it's very, very important. As a Northern European nation, we need to think what part it plays in our infrastructure.
I agree with James's analysis of the situation. I'd be less positive than he is about the future role for nuclear in the UK. And that's simply to do with economics. We're now seeing that solar energy and wind energy can both generate electricity at about 5p a kilowatt hour. Nuclear, currently, the forecast for Hinkley is 10p a kilowatt hour and going up. So there's a factor of two difference, and that's going to make any government reflect about which are the right technologies to be pushing forward. Now, it's not a trivial comparison because you need some additional costs to integrate variable renewables onto the energy system. But even taking that into account, given the very rapid reductions we've seen in offshore wind and the very big potential that there is for offshore wind in the UK, it's very clear that that's the industry where the UK is now worldwide leader, not, as James said, in nuclear anymore. So I think the crossroads is the right analogy, but the straight on is largely straight out of nuclear. So it's a bit of going to be a bit of a turn to go back into nuclear, I think.
Just to come back on that point, I mean, we're talking very much in the UK context, and one of the futures for the UK nuclear industry is actually not necessarily in the UK. The capability that we have in the UK is to build and design things such as small modular reactors, which within the UK probably don't have a market.
So this is smaller ones?
Smaller in terms of the amount of power they generate per unit. Physically, they're not that much smaller, but in terms of the power per unit, they are smaller. The concept is they are modular. They are easier to integrate with the grid and things like that. But one of the concepts for them is not for necessarily for use within the UK context, but for use in other countries where the energy grid is perhaps not engineered in the same way as the UK, or where you have a more dispersed population, you might want smaller scale power plants. And there are models for building small modular reactors, which are then exported and built in other countries, and as part of the fuel economies and fuel cycles, there are concepts out there.
Can you just explain, when you say modular?
Modular,
what exactly does that mean here?
Modular in the sense of you can, on the same site, you might have 4, 8, 10, 16 small power stations or small power plants which you connect together as modules. So each one generates a relatively small amount of power, the order of hundreds of megawatts, compared to a standard power station that generates maybe 1,000 megawatts. So the concept is they are smaller, easier to build. It's easier for other companies to come in and manufacture components.
So does that mean you might get economies of scale and bring down the price?
In particular, that's one of the strong arguments for small modular reactors, the economy of scale. The more you build, the more you learn. But going back to the point I was trying to make is that they are not necessarily for deployment within the UK energy sector. They could be, but I think many people thinking about them are viewing them as an export. So one way of maintaining a UK nuclear expertise without necessarily contributing to the energy economy in the UK is to export that technology to other nations,
right,
where really the big UK nuclear expertise is, and still very much, is in the fuel sector. Yeah, and so there are ways of thinking about the future of nuclear over the next few decades which are built around the small modular reactor concept, where it's an export technology rather than a local technology. Nick, if you have any thoughts on that.
I'd just add that I think the modularity and the economies of scale point is really important. The point I made earlier about nuclear having lost out in terms of cost over the last 10 years to wind and solar is because wind and solar are modular technologies, highly modular, particularly solar. Essentially, it's made in a factory, so you get the benefits of mass production, and that's something that we've never had with nuclear energy. Even at the 100 megawatt scale, it's harder to see that you get that than with solar power in particular.
And are other countries doing this kind of thing?
In the United States, there's quite significant interest in small modular reactors. They're very much in the same position that we're at, with an aging reactor fleet, an industry which is, I wouldn't say stagnant, but not growing greatly, wanting to maintain the expertise and build and rebuild the ability to construct nuclear plants. And they're also looking at small modular reactors. Within China, there's interest in all forms of reactor design, of which one is a small modular reactor. But most countries are at the level of building first-of-a-kind or relatively small numbers of plants where you don't have the advantage of scale. But everyone recognises it is an important thing to do. But you can't achieve it without building a fleet.
We could ask a bit about the people involved in the industry, because what I'm hearing a lot is here is the pressure to keep the nuclear industry going, to keep the skills alive, to keep that capability alive. So I think there are quite important questions to think of there in terms of what are the alternatives for people and for employment in future energy systems and with nuclear and with alternatives. So that you could also, for example, envisage alternatives in which an enormous amount of effort is put onto the demand side, which gets distressingly little attention, I think, given...
Do you mean demand for nuclear in particular?
I mean demand for energy services, because that's the only reason we have an energy system in the first place, because people want energy services.
Are you talking about the people who are employed in the nuclear industry? I mean...
I'm saying that is certainly, seems to me, a major driver for, you know, the pressure to keep investing in the nuclear industry.
What sort of numbers are we talking about here?
In this country, working in the nuclear industry, it'll be now about 20,000 people are we talking about? Something like that?
That would feel about right.
Yes.
There's a large number of, you know, there's a good number of reactors operating around the country.
Yeah.
Right, but I think many people would think, look, 20,000 people, okay, that's a fair number. It's not a huge number. And as you get more technologies coming in to give alternative sources of power, surely the skills they've got will be usable elsewhere. We're surely not going to keep the nuclear industry going in Britain, are we, given the public perception of it, just for the sake of providing employment for 20,000 people?
No, but it is, just to give you one point, it is one well worth remembering that most of the nuclear reactors within this country are positioned in relatively remote locations because of the need for cooling water, and they are quite often the dominant employer in those regions.
Yes.
So, you know, there are impacts to the closure of a nuclear power station, and you know, in very much the local area, in the same way as the closure of a major car factory and so on. They are local major employers. It's not a workforce which is thinly distributed around the country.
Okay. No, I see. Sarah?
No, but you compare that with the number of people employed in the construction industry, for example, and you imagine really getting them all to work on a major program of upgrading our buildings here, and what that could do for energy security, because, of course, the other side of the energy security coin from do we have enough supply is what's the level of demand. So
we're talking about insulation here. And
we're talking about, yes.
More efficient.
We're talking about really intelligent work on buildings, on the fabric and on the kit that's in them to bring to contain demand and manage it well. You put that effort in, then you're arguably achieving a lot more from employment that way. But I think it's also not just about numbers, but it is about the skills, and it's about the enormous investment, if you like, at the top end, the academic end, the scientific end, in doing research in nuclear. You know, there is a lot of pressure, I think, also from that end.
What I'm hearing is we've got various reasons for keeping nuclear going.
Yeah.
One of them is to do with the research interest and having the expertise, because nuclear does all sorts of interesting things and can be used in various ways to produce exotic materials and so on, no doubt. Another one is because we might want it in the future and we need to keep it going or we'll lose it. Another one is to help employment, particularly in some remote areas. I imagine a lot of people, including myself, would have been thinking that you'd be saying, actually, nuclear is likely to play a major role in the future because it provides reliable energy. It's not dependent on whether the wind's blowing, it's not dependent on whether the sun's shining, and it can be made safe.
I'd ask myself, why do I work in the nuclear? Yeah, why do I spend my efforts and time in the nuclear area? And yeah, my view is, it's very much in the long term. I take very much Nick's point about, you know, how much energy we produce from fossil fuels, and I take very much your point about the demand reduction in improving buildings. But fundamentally, we use energy for industrial processes. You know, the large part of it is heating stuff up to do stuff. Unless we can come up with very low temperature ways of manufacturing and things like that, there will always be a massive energy demand. And that's to maintain the level of technology and comfort that we experience here. There are massive populations around the world who aspire to that lifestyle, who will aspire and will require that magnitude of energy. And in the long term, that is not going to come from fossil fuels. Morally cannot, and also practically cannot, because we will run out of them. It'd be marvellous if it could come from solar and wind combined with storage, but there are challenges to scaling up energy production to that level through those technologies, which I think, you know, they in the long, very long term, they may be met. I'm not sure they can be met.
Can you elaborate a bit on the challenges? These highly populated countries get lots and lots of sun.
Yes, highly populated countries are full of people who need space to live, and solar fundamentally requires space to connect. And again, you can be very imaginative in thinking of the way you build your energy infrastructure, solar panels on roofs and things like that. But it's, you know, it requires a massive change and a lot of imagination to get to that stage. So going back to the reason why I think, you know, why I invest my time in nuclear is I believe it is the way we will produce the large amounts of energy that we will require as a globally towards the back end of the 21st century.
I think this is where I disagree with James, because I think in most countries we can relatively easily supply all the energy that we need from those renewable energy sources. How much energy do we need? In a country like this, probably half the amount we currently use. If I look up in your room, Peter, I see some light bulbs. They could easily be twice as efficient if they were replaced. And that goes for a lot of our buildings. So it's not just insulation, it's a range of things. And if you then calculate how much of the land area in Britain we would need to supply all our energy from solar, and I'm not suggesting we should supply all our energy from solar, but if we did, it would be about 1% of the land area that would be covered by solar panels. Now, that's an awful lot. You know, it's a huge area. So it would be, as James said, a major challenge to do that. But I don't think people should run away with the idea that it would occupy vast amounts of the country, that we wouldn't be able to have space for housing or for agriculture or for other uses.
There are other challenges as well, though, right? I mean, solar technology requires certain materials, rare elements and things like that.
Yeah, there are challenges for any industrial technology in that way. Nuclear requires specialised steels, magnets require specialised materials, batteries do. But I think most people think that these problems can be solved by substitution. The main component of a solar cell is silicon, and there's an awful lot of sand in the world to make silicon out of. So there are challenges. I mean, the biggest challenge with solar is the most obvious one,
storage.
Which is that it's only sunny for part of the time, which is why I wouldn't suggest we had a 100% solar system. But 100% solar and wind would be technically possible. National Grid are now very comfortable with the idea of running a 100% low-carbon grid by 2025. That would include some nuclear and some biomass, so it wouldn't be all variable renewables. But I think we could get there if we wanted to. It's a question of, as with nuclear, do we want to do this? Do we want to go one way? Do we want to go another way?
No, I was just going to come in on the point about the solar wind grid. I think that's fantastic, but that's at our current level of electricity use. Yeah, do you think it's feasible to have a solar wind grid which supplied the total amount of energy that we required, even at the lower level you think we can aspire to?
Yeah, it would. If we halved energy use, that would mean we'd have to between double and treble electricity demand to supply everything from electricity. So the estimates I've seen in numbers mean changing our electricity demand in this country from 300 terawatt hours a year to somewhere in the range 600 to 800 terawatt hours a year. That looks feasible. That's a massive challenge, doubling our electricity supply system. So even doing that over 30 years is going to be tough, irrespective of whether we do it with nuclear, solar, wind, biomass, or whatever combination we use. That's going to be a challenge. But actually, it's probably less of a challenge than decarbonising transport, decarbonising industry, for the reasons that James has pointed out, and decarbonising our building stock. So there's a bunch of difficult challenges there, but I think in decarbonising electricity, we've got some choices, actually.
Just want to pick up one point. One of the areas of nuclear which is not talked about a lot is we currently view nuclear as a way of producing electricity, and that's true of all the current reactor designs that we build around the world. If we look forward to what are called the Generation 4 technologies, some of those are what you would call a very high temperature reactor, where their purpose is not to produce electricity, but simply to produce heat, process heat. So you know, many manufacturing processes, we either burn gas to produce the heat, or we burn gas to make electricity, which we then use to heat things up. It's a very inefficient way of doing it. But if one has an economical way and a clean way of producing process heat, you then have the tools for example, producing hydrogen easily as a fuel, which, you know, transportable fuel for vehicles and things like that. One has a way of unlocking many chemical processes and bringing the cost of those chemical processes down because you can run them at higher temperatures. So there are concepts out there, you know, designs and working solutions for nuclear reactors whose whole purpose is to produce heat.
And if solar and wind are able to provide our energy needs, we won't need hydrogen as a fuel, will we? And so we won't need nuclear plants in order to produce it.
There are other uses you can make of for the production of high temperature with these high temperature plants, you know, one of which would be desalination. You know, so it's not something we necessarily use in this country or within any part of Northern Europe. But the countries with quite a demand for energy, quite a demand for water, and where can that water come from? Well, it's the desalination of seawater that requires heat and energy. So I was really trying to bring these in as examples of nuclear is not just electricity.
Yeah, sure. But the heat that you need for desalination, can't that be provided by other sources of electricity?
Yeah, there are ways of doing it. And there are ideas also in terms of concentrated solar power, where one can use the heat from solar power for desalination. It's not black and white. These are all technologies which have their merits and demerits for doing the things that we want. It's all a case of cost, scale, and the opportunities for developing these technologies.
But I mean, the strongest argument that most people will want to put against nuclear, I think, is going to be, it's got a bad name because of the cleanup costs and dealing with the rubbish that it leaves behind. Sarah?
Yes, with good reason, of course. There's only one country in the world, Finland, one of the most geologically and politically stable countries in the world, that has now got a deep disposal facility open that has just started running.
Deep disposal, can you explain?
Well, they've dug a long way into a very solid mountain and they are taking stuff down there that will be, and with the intention, they are taking highly active radioactive waste down there with the intention that it will be there for infinity, really.
So what does deep disposal involve?
It involves going into very stable geological formations that you hope will remain stable for many thousands of years, and putting extremely well-wrapped, highly active radioactive waste into those facilities and then sealing them up. And also
Forever.
And also an issue that the Scandinavians have been thinking about quite hard, wondering about how you signpost these for future generations.
Won't future generations be able to tell they're there because they'll have clever technology that will detect the radioactivity?
Well, future generations, maybe back to the Stone Age. Who knows? Don't know. Trying to explain that they must not go there under any circumstances because there's dangerous stuff down there. In this country, of course, for decades now, there have been attempts to find ways of securing some sort of permanent disposal, and we still haven't found one.
How good are we at dealing with nuclear waste?
That is quite a tricky one to answer, but most of the high active waste is stored at Sellafield. It's in ponds, it's in casks, which are slowly starting to corrode. So it's certainly an issue and a troubling one.
And how serious, I mean, is this worry? I mean, am I right in saying that the number of actual deaths from nuclear accidents and so on is worldwide pretty tiny? I mean, there have been some notable exceptions, but in general, a lot of people would think that fears of nuclear are disproportionate to the actual dangers.
The number of deaths you can directly attribute to failures at a nuclear plant are not large, that's true, but we're talking about disposal and waste here and the release of radioactive waste. So when we're talking about, I think it's in the region of 140, 150 tonnes of plutonium at Sellafield, which is about the most, the most toxic material known, you're talking about something very serious indeed there.
I first of all agree completely that nuclear waste is the challenge for nuclear technology. Without solving the nuclear waste problem, nuclear technology has no future at all. But there are there are two ways into the nuclear waste problem. It largely comes down to waste minimisation. And one of the ways to minimise waste is the recycling of nuclear fuel. And again, one of the technologies, the Generation 4 technologies, the fast reactor technologies, they are designed to reprocess or reuse fuel. You can use plutonium, mixed oxide fuels within the fast reactors and essentially burn the waste. It's actually true that the high-level waste that comes from a light water reactor has an activity of several hundred thousand of years, so you have to worry about that potential. As part of a fuel economy, which uses both fast reactors and light water reactors, it is feasible to bring that active lifetime down to a few thousand years or shorter, which then becomes reasonable in terms of human memory and things like that. So there is a solution. It's not an easy solution. The technology exists. It has been demonstrated. These fuels can be burned. The physics works.
How common are the Generation 4 reactors?
They don't exist.
So,
but they have, yeah. So all the concepts which are, pretty much all the concepts which are labelled as Generation 4 were actually designs which were built, several of them in this country, back in the 60s. They were demonstrated to work. You got plants. You got Dragon, which was the high temperature gas cooled reactor. I forget the name of the sodium fast cooled reactor, but we built that as a European project back in the 60s. So the physics works. The French had the Phoenix fast reactor, where they demonstrated that this physics of the burning of the waste to reduce the amount of plutonium and to shorten lifetime works.
Why haven't they caught on?
Well, because it's expensive. Yeah, and there are other things to do. And we're as bad at dealing with nuclear waste as we are at sorting out Brexit. One has to make decisions. Yeah,
right.
And follow through or not follow through, depending on your stance. So all these things can be done. Yeah, but there are other things we do, and we delay the decision. So,
nuclear waste is a big problem, right? Even if you only have to deal with it for a few thousand years.
Yes.
It's hard enough to get politicians to focus on things that are 5 years away, let alone 5,000
years.
So you
deal with these big problems when you find the solutions to these big problems when you really need the energy. And so, again, if I go back to my long-term view, you could have a nuclear playing a large part of your energy economy, but one has to have it as part of this full cycle. You have to have the fast reactors, the light reactors, because, again, uranium is a fossil fuel. They're not making any more of it, except in some reactors. So, long-term, it is a finite resource. One way of managing that is through the fast reactor system. But so one can build very complex, ambitious plans to solve the energy crisis or the energy problems. So the techniques are there.
James has made a really important point there that I would expand to covering all the three things about nuclear power that people have historically worried about, which are the waste, the reactor safety, and the link to weapons. And I agree with you, technically they're all soluble. We could do it if we wanted to, is one way of looking at it. But I think what it means in another way is that it's a social problem. The question is not, could we envisage a way of making reactors very, very safe? As we know from the disasters that have happened at Chernobyl, it's not the technology that went wrong, it's the people that went wrong. And I think that's the same across those three spaces.
Is it not true that the general public horror of nuclear is out of proportion to the risk? But that's not going to change anytime soon, is it? I mean, that is, if you say to the British public, which would you rather, have 1% of the land area of the UK covered with solar panels or have lots of nuclear reactors that take up a lot less space, they're going to go overwhelmingly, I think, for the 1% land area of solar, aren't they?
I would guess so. It would be an interesting thing to do. I think my point is that there are, although the risks of, say, a major reactor accident are very low, the consequences are very high. And we know that people have difficulty in trying to process how to deal with those sorts of situations because we don't experience them almost by definition.
You mean like people get more concerned about a single plane crash than lots of people getting killed on the roads?
Exactly that. Yeah. But the largest conceivable outcome of a nuclear disaster at a British power station is still very, very big indeed. It is that the whole of London gets covered by a radioactive plume. It's very unlikely, but it is possible, and people know that.
Can I just come back on that? And I know I keep going back to the Generation 4 designs, but because they're, you know, I entirely agree. Current generation reactors, very safe, but there is, you know, there have been nuclear accidents. You know, that fundamentally, those types of reactors can have accidents. There are designs, the Generation 4 designs, which are passively safe. You know, from the very physics of the way the reactor works, you cannot have that kind of nuclear accident.
Do you mean they shut down unless
basically,
they're kept going?
The hotter they get, the lower the power goes, yeah? The underlying principle of the design of the Generation 4 reactors is they have to be passively safe. They have to be
passively safe.
Passively safe means you can walk away and it will shut down. You know,
yeah.
So that's the concept. They have to be proliferation resistant. They have to be economical. Those are the design principles. So it's an ambition. Yeah. But the designs are there to do it. The physics has been shown to work. That is a future for nuclear, a long-term future for nuclear.
But if I understand correctly the gist of this conversation, that long-term future is probably going to rely on developments outside this country. Is that right?
I think that would be correct, yes. I mean, the UK was a leader in the Generation 4 technology, so the first designs were built here. Most of the effort in Generation 4 is now happening outside the UK. You have things like the Generation 4 International Forum, which is an international collaboration between various nations. The UK was one of the founding partners, and actually we've just rejoined GIF as an active member, so it gives us the opportunity to interact with international programmes. But yeah, these designs will only be solved by internationally. The large-scale stuff is international effort.
And other countries are putting energies into nuclear where we're not. Is it because they're less concerned about the costs?
I think it's because they want the energy. Their populations want energy. They're heavily reliant currently on fossil fuels. They want to decrease that. They want to have choices for energy production.
Which countries are we talking about particularly?
I would say, for example, China is a good example. They're actively pursuing energy of all forms, but they're building gas-cooled fast reactors, high-temperature gas reactors. India is building a sodium fast-cooled reactor. So these Generation 4 technologies, people are building them and developing the technology.
Is anything like that going on in Europe?
There are various European collaborations led by the under Euratom, things like that. So you've got there's a sodium fast cooled reactor is the leading design, and people actually think you're looking at the active design of that. You've got various concepts for gas cooled reactors. So there are international collaborations to design these. They're mostly at the research level. At some point, someone has to pull their wallet out and say, right, we're going to build it, in the same way that fusion. People are now people are building the demonstration plants for fusion. So these big projects require international collaboration because they are challenging.
I'll be interested to come back to fusion shortly, but first of all, is it quite likely that in 50 years' time, say, solar and wind will have replaced all these nuclear power stations that are now being developed in these other countries? Or do they really envisage fission, nuclear fission, with all the waste problems and so forth, as part of their long-term future?
My understanding is it's a long-term view. Yeah, they're investing in their future. They want to have the option to have these technologies available.
Right. And is that because they're not confident that other technologies will fill their need?
I would imagine so. I don't know for sure. I'm struggling here to answer that one.
Sarah, do you think they're being imprudent in this? I mean, given the known problems about nuclear waste, is it maybe that they are going for short-term gain and ignoring a long-term serious problem?
Not that short-term again, I think, given the lead time for nuclear plants. I think they're responding to some extent to what you might call heavy marketing from the nuclear industry, that they're being offered a solution to their problem, which I think will almost inevitably turn out to be a lot more complicated than they bargained for. You know, looking at how these projects actually work in practice. I mean, the pioneer new generation reactors in Europe, Flamanville and Olkiluoto, for example, at the moment the cost just goes on and on rising. I think it's about three times the original cost in Olkiluoto. It's about 10 years behind time. You know, this is the kind of thing that's being faced.
Those are very important examples, but those are not what I would put in the box of Generation 4 reactors. They are just evolutions of the current technology.
Yes, and with Generation 4, I mean, as you've said, these are very high aspirations indeed for Generation
Absolutely,
4.
Yes, yes.
And so we're thinking that, okay, they can eat up, as it were, our plutonium stocks. So that all that plutonium has to be transported to the countries in question and safely delivered, safely handled. The Generation 4 reactors have to be built exactly to specification because they're designed to be passively safe. That means every single component absolutely has to be done right. Nobody has to cut any corners. There's to be no corruption in the process. You know, it is a very high aspiration.
I agree, it's a high aspiration.
And yeah. High risk from your suggestion.
I think, yes, indeed.
But again, I would put against that is, you know, there is this massive need for energy, even with all the energy demand potential globally. There will be a massive demand for energy. And I think those who are investing their time and effort and money in these technologies, and if I put fusion in that box again, are saying, how are we going to solve the energy problems of the late 21st, 22nd century? How are we going to have the technologies and the choices available to us to do that? Can we rely completely on providing that energy through solar, wind, wave? Will it meet that demand? Because if it's not going to meet that demand, what are we going to do?
Isn't the obvious thing to do to put our investment towards nuclear fusion? Because nuclear fusion, as I understand it, you take a couple of atoms of hydrogen, put them together to make helium, or is it four atoms of hydrogen, I guess, and you get energy out. It's what happens in the sun, and it's safe. It doesn't produce any radioactive materials.
Yes, it's just very difficult to do, but it can be done.
But it was difficult to get to the moon,
yes.
And we got to the moon,
a
dozen years or something after the first satellite went up. So if there was a real will to produce energy from nuclear power, isn't the obvious thing to do to put our efforts and money and investment and thinking into getting fusion working?
I think the moonshot analogy is quite a nice one, because when they went to the moon, they didn't worry too much about the cost. And
That's true.
The thing that holds back a lot of the developments of these really promising energy technologies is short-term, they are not at all competitive with all the other choices that anybody can make, any investor, any government investing in its nation. They are really long-term bets.
How good a bet is nuclear fusion? I mean, we know nuclear fusion works in the sun. There have been experiments on nuclear fusion that have been fairly successful.
Nuclear fusion
but
has
it's
happened
difficult to get
just
it to
20 miles away from here. So nuclear fusion works. Cullum have done fusion. So
right, and have they got more energy from the reactor than they put into it?
No, because they weren't intending
okay.
to. Yeah.
So some people might say that your definition of works is a slightly bizarre one if we're talking about methods of energy generation.
Yeah, but you have to put fusion, you have to think the same way that nuclear fission also went through all the steps of becoming a technology.
Okay.
So first you prove the physics,
yeah.
Then you prove that you can actually build something where you get more energy out than you put in. And that's, for example, the International Fusion Reactor that's being built at Cadarache at the moment. Big international project.
Right.
Its concept is to prove you can do fusion at scale.
So that's the concept,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
It's going to prove it.
Yes.
So it's not yet proved.
No, it's being built. If you go on the web and look up ITER, you will see a massive building site that, you know, they've been building it for the past decade.
So when's the proof going to come? I mean, a decade is quite a long time.
Yeah, I think within the next 5-10 years, that's when they're expecting to have ITER functioning. ITER is there to demonstrate technology and also to demonstrate to develop the kind of technology you'll need for the one that comes after. I feel like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy here, which is demo, where demo is your demonstration power plant, fusion power plant, says, yes, we can produce the energy, we can produce this economically, we can work out the fuel cycle.
And right, economics tends to come with scale, right? So is it going to be the case, do you think, that if ITER proves its worth in, say, the next decade, suddenly people around the world are going to say, hey, we should be doing this. It will work in scale, and it's far more sensible to put our effort into that than into nuclear fission.
That could be the case. Again, one of the other arguments for keeping the effort going on the nuclear fission is many of the engineering problems which are required to be solved for fusion, operation of materials at high temperatures for a long time, operation of materials under radiation fields, things like that. Those are the things which need to be solved also for the Generation 4 nuclear fission. And so, you know, many of the reasons why, you know, the reactors which were built and designed back in the 60s and 70s did not operate for longer or were not continued is because many of the engineering components, the materials, could not survive reliably for your power station to last long enough to be economical.
So how long could they last?
From memory, they lasted about 5 or 10 years at best. One needs a power station. If you build a power station now, you want to get minimum 40 years, ideally 60 years, and people talk about 80 years.
And we've
lifetime.
Got materials that can do that, have we?
For current nuclear reactors, yes. For Generation 4, I would say no, not yet. And for fusion, who knows? So those are the challenges. So it boils down to, if you really, we really want the energy, and we don't have other ways of doing it, so we can put all our bets on solar and wind and say that'll be fine, we'll solve it. But if we're not confident that that is the solution, we need to have something else in the bag.
And are you suggesting that we can't at the moment be absolutely confident that nuclear fusion will do it? So we need to keep fission going?
I think so. I think fission is very much the bridge to fusion, would be my argument, my viewpoint. Right. Yeah. There are others with otherwise. I mean, the fusion is quite a busy area. There are concepts out there for small reactors, small talking about reactors. There's lots of ideas for hot fusion. Okay, which are competing with the large scale.
That's a bit of a scoff from Nick there. I assume you're thinking about the alternative cold fusion.
I get very clear for cold fusion.
I'm a nuclear physicist by background, so I've never believed that chemists could deliver fusion, yes.
Right.
I'm a fan of doing the science because I'm a nuclear physicist, and I think it's interesting work to do anyway, even if it doesn't have an energy outcome. There's no doubt in my mind that fusion will be hugely important. The question is whether it's ones we build here on Earth or the big one up in the sky that's 150 million kilometres away.
Right, yes.
And my, as I said earlier, my guess is that the latter is likely to be a much more important source of fusion than the former.
Do you think that in 100 years' time we'll have solved nuclear fusion to produce energy in industrial quantities here on Earth?
I don't know. I think it will be much cheaper and more efficient to make some relatively minor improvements in energy storage and use the big bright ball in the sky. That would be my guess. But if you're talking about the energy system in 100 years' time, it's a guess.
Sure. And Sarah?
I'd add in as well, we shouldn't ever make the mistake of assuming that current trends in demand are inevitably going to go upwards. As we've shown in this country, demand has been coming down in spite of an increase in population over the past 15 years.
Right, but if the rest of the world wants to emulate us in our energy usage, or at least the things that we do that require lots of energy, that's going to multiply hugely the energy demand across the world, isn't it?
Not necessarily, because it will depend what sort of services they're wanting it for and the sort of infrastructure they have for using it. I mean, we've just been through quite an unusual period in human history when the industrialised countries of the world have been burning energy quite literally as though there's no tomorrow. In extraordinarily wasteful ways. And that particular party is coming to an end now, and we're having to think about, as I say, using it a lot more intelligently and in thinking of energy transition as something that's always local. It's not just a global thing, and it takes different forms in different places. So, for example, if you're in East Africa in a small community that isn't attached to the grid, you may want quite small amounts of electricity at first. You'll want it for your mobile phone, which you're probably using to conduct your business on these days. You'll want it for some community facilities like hairdressing salon, for example. I gather that's a very important social use, and for running your business, for running a workshop, things like that. And that's the kind of thing that can very readily be met by using locally available solar, as long as you've got a good engineer in the village, you know, who can run the thing.
But they're going to want to get on a grid ultimately, aren't they? And we've got, 6 billion people who are going to want to emulate the luxuries of the rich part of the world, aren't they? Isn't that going
to... Well, are they? I mean, I don't think we all want to live as though we're in Caesar's palace, perhaps.
I think, listen, I mean, I would dispute that. We're seeing some trends in some countries with people desperate to get off the grid.
Yes.
Right. to be self-reliant. Now, I'm not saying that's a major trend, but I think what people want is not to be on the grid or off the grid. It's reliable energy services.
It's the reliability. Right?
That's what
yes.
they want. Mm. And if we and whether that's provided by a fusion power station and the power coming 100 kilometres or by a solar panel on their roof, I think actually most people probably don't care that much actually.
Yeah, but it's a nice vision, but they also still want the glasses to drink from. They want the clothes. They want the vehicles to move them around. We forget all the hidden energy which is required to make the things we use, sit on, live inside. We can all reduce our energy, our personal energy use, but you know, unless we can radically reduce the amount of energy required to make the things we use or completely change our lifestyle, the way we live, I don't see energy demands dropping by orders of magnitude. I
mean, aren't there billions of people who are going to want?
But that's what you would need. If we have there's orders of magnitude of population with lifestyle with energy consumption, which is way below our energy consumption, and so there will be order of magnitude increases in the amount of energy unless they come to the same.
Can I just give the example of air conditioning? I mean, we've got very very large populations in very hot areas, and the Earth is heating as well. I mean. Isn't air conditioning something that billions of people potentially will want? That, I mean, it can be quite efficient, but nevertheless, it demands a significant amount of
energy. Yeah, and actually, it's. I'm not saying it's not a significant problem, and as Sarah said, we need to design buildings better to reduce the issue. But one of the great advantages that potential air conditioning demand has is that it could be supplied by solar because it's very closely linked in time and space to solar. It's almost the best fit for an energy service with solar energy.
But we're
as James has said, I think there are more difficult questions about how you produce steel and how you produce cement and chemicals where you need a large amount of energy in one place. And I agree, those are the energy demands we need to think hard about.
So building all these energy efficient houses and so on, that's itself going to require a lot of energy in both production of materials and transport and so forth. So
yes.
It's going to be quite a long time before we get to the utopia of...
Absolutely, yeah. And there is now discussion about the next round of building regulations that controls energy use in buildings, looking at the energy in the embedded materials as well as the energy that's used over the lifetime of the building. Currently, the latter is much bigger than the former because we have such leaky buildings, but as we get better buildings, then the embedded energy will become a bigger fraction and we need to think hard about it.
So we've got major energy needs for the foreseeable future. We've got some renewable forms of energy that can provide, that look very promising. Do they look promising enough to really supply, ultimately, all the energy needs? I mean, for example, solar cells. Is there really enough material to produce all that we need? I mean, if we multiply up by 100 or 1,000 or whatever.
Yes, I'm confident we could supply, or ultimately we could supply all the energy we need from solar or from wind or from nuclear. They're none of them a sufficiently constrained resource that they won't supply our energy need. It's a choice, and that will be made partly on social grounds, but I think largely on economic grounds, which is why I would be more optimistic about wind and solar at the moment than nuclear, because that's where the cost trends are pointing.
Just suppose that we had the money and the facilities to create today loads and loads of solar cells, as many as we want. Would it be straightforward to transition to a purely solar and wind renewable future?
Not entirely, no, because when you have much more distributed forms of electricity supply, you have to operate the network in different ways. The network we have at the moment is designed, the electricity network, it's designed to take electricity from big central power stations to customers. And we're increasingly, we're moving into a situation where there are suppliers, small-scale suppliers all over the place, and they are also customers because people are generating their own electricity. So the network has to cope with two-way flows, and that is more complicated for them to do. And so what we are seeing already underway, though, is that transition starting to happen. And indeed, we've have something now underway, Local Energy Oxfordshire, which is developing this and testing it out and acting as a demonstrator for this. So it's a gradual change that has already started to happen and that we can expect to see a lot more of, I think.
And is this a gradual change that we can also be pretty confident will go through without any huge problems? I mean, can we see our way to it relatively straightforwardly?
Yes, without huge problems. It'll have teething troubles as everything does. But yes, I would think we could.
But we're not going to suddenly hit some roadblock that proves that we can't.
I wouldn't see that, no.
No. Okay. Well, thank you very much. Just to sum up this really interesting discussion, we clearly can't go on relying on fossil fuels indefinitely. And nuclear energy is one of the most prominent alternative sources. It seems fairly likely that within a couple of decades, we'll know whether nuclear fusion is going to be a feasible technology. At the moment, the UK, as we've discussed, is at something of a crossroads on energy usage in general and nuclear in particular. So from that crossroads, which road do you think we should take and which road do you think we actually will take? Nick?
I guess my two starting points would be one, that the future is fundamentally unknowable, that we have to make judgments about it. The second is that we know that to maintain a livable climate on the Earth, we have to move away from fossil fuels quickly by the standards at which industrial transitions have been made in the past. So it seems to me that we need to do two things. One is research on the options, and we should be trying to keep open and advance as many options as we reasonably can at the research level. But the second is we have to do stuff as well. We have to implement things. We have to get going on the low carbon transition. I think that rules out fusion to me for as being a significant player, because it won't contribute on the timescales on which we need to address climate change. And as I said earlier, I think the best guesses are the technologies that look economic and look socially acceptable now, and those are improving energy efficiency and wind and solar. So I'm not ruling out other things, but I think that those should be the technologies that we're implementing now, and we should be doing lots of research on a variety of technologies to keep other options open for the future.
Thank you. James?
It's a difficult one. I mean, we're at a crossroads. If the UK chooses not to go down the nuclear route, others will. I mean, there are plenty of other countries around the world who are pursuing that. And I've talked mostly today about how nuclear is a long-term option. You know, there is a shorter-term option. One can build a lot of light water reactors relatively quickly, and they are, you know, in the shorter term, a clean form of energy. It still leaves us with problems further down the road to sort out in terms of generation four and fusion and so on. Longer term, the challenges of fusion for the next few decades and Gen 4 fission are not really solvable by single nation states. So the future in that area is international collaboration, as we've seen with the Fusion ITER project, as we see with the various large-scale European projects on Gen 4. So I believe that, you know, even if the UK chooses not to continue down the nuclear route, it really needs to keep itself at the table in these international programs to have those choices later on, to have the research infrastructure and the knowledge to be, or the language is the intelligent customer. So even if we have to buy in these technologies a number of decades down the route, we are able to use them and benefit from them. So I think we need to stay actively involved, even if, you know, for short-term economic reasons, we choose not to build more nuclear plant here over the next couple of decades, but we must stay involved.
Thank you. Sarah?
Where we should go, I would think very much along the route of thinking and reimagining how we use energy, thinking very hard about changing the forms of demand we have. So that means, yes, continuing to do a lot more of what we've started to do in energy efficiency in buildings and in appliances and so on, rethinking the way that we move people and stuff around and not assuming it always has to be done using fossil fuels. I speak from a cycling city with thousands of happy and fairly healthy cyclists. In terms of what we should be, what we will do, these are strange political times, of course, but I think any politician with their ear to the ground can see big concerns arising about the future of employment, for example, and the importance of developing skills in young people and having rewarding employment for them. Otherwise, we're building up terrible problems for ourselves in the future. And it seems to me there are enormous opportunities in building up skills and developing the construction industry so that it can produce for us a really comfortable, enjoyable, low energy built environment, good transport networks and other infrastructure. And once that done, then we're doing really, really making quite a significant impact on our energy demand. And we're also paving the way for meeting that demand through renewable supply. So I think there is there could be happy coincidence between what we should do and what is quite feasible politically in the next 5, 10, 15 years.
But nuclear not playing much of a role, if any?
I think we're talking about concentrating our activities in decommission and disposal there, yeah.
Right, then that's going to take quite a long time.
It is indeed, yes.
Well, thank you all very much. That's been a very interesting and enlightening discussion. I've come away from it with somewhat changed views from how I started it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My thanks again to Nick, Sarah and James for their time this week, and also to all of our Future Makers listeners. We hope you're enjoying our series. If you are, please give us a rating and leave a review. It helps other people discover the podcast, and it keeps my producers happy, which makes my life easier. Until then, I'm Peter Milliken, and you've been listening to Future Makers.